Thank you all for coming back. I'm flattered that you're subjecting yourself to more of this. There are three things that I forgot to say, or that I wanted to, that are worth saying, that I want to say. The first one is, I was trying to talk about the restoration of via non-perturbative effects of the correlations between some initial perturbation and the final measurement in the context of graphene ABS. And so I said that the non-perturbative effects can produce things that look like this, which restore the correct time average. But it's important to emphasize that the details of how this actually restores the quasi-periodic behavior are totally still not understood. And so one way you can see this is, you see this gives the right average over time, but something of a function of this form, you know, so I suppose this is like cosine t, cannot be quasi-periodic because this thing never reaches its initial value again. Right, so no matter how long you wait, it still never gets back to the end state there. And so the actual, even in cases that are best understood, we don't know exactly what you have to sum over to get to restore it.
So this is unresolved.
Yeah. You should figure this out. okay. The second thing I forgot to say was, oh, yeah. That was a grand part of our life. It's not the story.
It's a copy. You can't classify
The closest the best attempt I've seen is by Parati, Kliban, and Rabadan, where they do it for ADS3 by summing over ways of filling in the donut, and they show that that's not enough. And some simple intuition for why that's not enough is, you know, even if you know that's some order one number of solutions, whereas you kind of need to sum over e to the n squared solutions, right, to cancel this factor.
Even
the
complex or imaginary sound.
Yeah. Yeah, this is...
Or strings?
Yeah,
strings. Sorry, may I ask a question?
Please.
So it seems to me that you're discussing some correlation functions in a thermodynamic state. Is it sensible to formulate a non-equilibrium problem?
Yes.
And if so, is this theory integrable?
No.
In the sense that, well, if you prepare some initial condition, would it ever relax to some equilibrium state?
That's a very interesting question. Joseph and I actually just wrote a paper about this. So it's not integrable. And if you, there are things you can do where it will actually return equilibrium. But there are actually some funny things that because of conformal invariance will prevent it from equilibrating. But if you break conformal invariance, it will equilibrate. Yeah. And people have actually done this. By solving Einstein's equations in asymmetric ABS geometry, starting from some initial condition, which is, you know, not the black hole, and you know, numerically integrating, watching the black hole form, watching the thing return to equilibrium. So this is, by the way, I should say, something that for a problem for which this machine should be used. It's like, you know, solving PDEs is much easier than solving a many-body system far from equilibrium. Mm-hmm. But it would help if we knew better what the right questions to ask about such things were.
So, for instance, thermalization might be an interesting question.
Yeah, that's right. There has been quite a bit of work on this, but I think there's still a huge opportunity. The second important remark that I forgot to make is, so I mentioned that the Planck form of the third law is not true for black holes. That the right statement is not that there are no zero temperature black holes with non-zero area, because there are. And in fact, the included among those are the cases that we understand best. Because sometimes extremal black holes preserve some fraction of supersymmetry.
Supersymmetry did not mention those words so far.
Yeah, isn't that great?
So why are you mentioning it now? We made it into the entire discussion.
So if we happen, so where I said understand best. So if we happen to be studying a supersymmetric theory, and we happen to study black holes that preserve some amount of supersymmetry, then sometimes we can account for their ground state entropy by some counting of supersymmetric ground states of some system to which they're adiabatically connected by variation of parameters.
So if the endemic product restore this periodicity, or
say again?
Those cases can restore this.
Oh.
No, I guess not. Well, actually, maybe. Yeah. No, I think the answer to that question is, I think there has been some progress on that. The initial progress was setting a limit where the charge of the black hole was large and expanding around, doing the expansion around infinite charge. But more recently, people have developed a much more refined understanding, which I think actually, which answers yes to your question. Okay, then I'm going to have to put many references on the wiki. Good. And then finally, the third thing I wanted to say was, I just wanted to clarify this remark since some people expressed some bewilderment about it. So a property of simple holographic quantum field theories that we can infer just from first principles is that although there are many degrees of freedom per point, most of the states of the system are not accessible using the low-dimensional operators. And based on very simple facts, we can see that the density of states of the system has some form like this, which if we plug that into the partition function, at large n, we can do this integral by saddle point and see that this thing goes like even some number times n squared, which says that the free energy and the energy density, even at a temperature of order 1, goes like n squared. So this is a very funny thing that the states that are the excitations in the black hole are very high energy excitations, even at a very small temperature. And this is happening because there's a whole lot of them, because there's so many of them. Okay, and these are the states that are being coarse grained over by the geometry. All right, so now comes the right turn, left turn maybe. So we've heard many times so far that a way to describe a finite density holographically, finite density of something, we won't have specified what, is to consider a holographic CFT with a conserved current, some conserved V1 current, J mu, which means that in the bulk there's a massless gauge field. Right, this I can say, not explain any further, right? And turn on a chemical potential. So this U1, that means that there's a boundary condition that near the boundary of ABS, this thing should approach a constant, which is the chemical potential. So we should specify the problem a little further. In order to say what happens, we need to say what the bulk theory is. And so here I'm actually making a very strong, I'm making an assumption. And there's, how strong that assumption is a question for the study of the string landscape, which is maybe a subject for another time. A reasonable action for the metric and this gauge field is something like this. So nobody will complain if I write down, 1 over 16 g Newton integral over the bulk, and that's the Hilbert term, a cosmological constant, and a Maxwell term for this gauge field. And then we'll stop that. So already in doing this, I've actually made quite strong assumptions. And if you consider instead some other system, you can get other answers. But there are various theorems about the inevitability of the conclusions that we'll come to, which we can talk about if you want to. Okay, so a reasonable action is something like this. And if there's nothing else, so this is an important assumption which I should put like stars around. If there's no charged matter in the bulk, which gets excited by turning this boundary condition, and if the action is this, then the static solution, the solution with the right boundary condition, with these boundary conditions, is the Reisner-Norton black hole. Which is of the following form. I guess I'm redefining my F relative to before. really looks like this. And I'm also, so I'm doing two things. I'm redefining f in an annoying way, and I'm considering instead flat space. So this is just Euclidean metric on some number of space dimensions. And I also set, I chose units where the ADS radius was 1. And there's also a gauge field, which is something like mu dt, 1 minus r out of the bar, d minus 2. And the form of the embracking factor is 1 minus m over r to d plus q over r to the 2d minus 2. And r naught is the place where this vanishes. OK. All right, so that's a lot of symbols. Yes, please. Okay.
So in David's talk yesterday, she was talking about all these other traditions that did not have that rules.
Yes. Well, no, they did, actually. The system she was studying did also have a black hole solution, but she was claiming that the solution that she was studying was better. And what I mean by better is in this sense, that these solutions are, you know, are competing with each other to dominate this path integral with some given boundary condition. There's saddle points which compete with each other, and the one with the smallest action wins is the one that dominates, because any difference in the action suppresses them by an amount.
So to the claim is the thing without this Lipschitz thing, without the black hole, this
has a better free energy.
Yeah. So is it?
Well, I assume she checked it.
But what are you doing? I'm a computer. Then
So she was studying a system which does not satisfy this assumption.
Okay.
Yeah. That's right. And so this is what
did she have? I mean, it looked like
this is
the
only
thing she has to boundary condition is the chemical tension.
So this is why it would have been nice to have our talks in the other order, because this is a much simpler thing. So what did she have? She had some brains, right? She had instead of this kind of action, she had a Born-Enfeld action. Is that the only difference?
Yeah. She had a what?
Born-Enfeld action.
She had
good. So she had two differences. One is that instead of just this very nice, simple-looking Maxwell term, she instead had something of the form square root of 1 minus x squared, which it looks like a strange thing, but is actually it is technically natural because of stringy symmetries. Technically natural in the tough sense. And therefore good.
So this is not natural then?
No, this is obviously natural. also technically natural. It's obviously technically natural.
All natural. If you could say natural, I'm going to bring up measures.
No, I mean, it's very specific. I mean, it's, there's a symmetry that's restored.
But what else is natural? Could I add an F wedge, F term? Would that be natural?
Yes, that's perfectly fine.
That would be natural, but not square root of 1 minus F.
Okay.
Yeah, you can add an F wedge F term and it wouldn't matter for anything. Yeah.
Okay.
So
I could play
it on
with
symmetry. But from the point of view of the dual field theory, what's a little unnatural, not in the technical sense, but about this action is we want to have some operators in the dual field theory. And the assumption that's made here is that the only relevant operators are the stress tensor and one current. And if you have other operators that are playing an important role in the dynamics, there would be fields that appear in this Lagrangian, and their couplings could change the solution.
Good. Yeah, and that relevant there was not in the technical sense. Yeah. The only germane operators were. Wilson really did us a disservice by co-opting these useful words. Okay. Good. So this assumption of the small list of operators is that's in this word here. So.
And what's A?
A is this gauge field. Okay. So it's the operator that's dual to the conserved current. A, where's A? This A.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the gauge field.
Okay.
So I've written it as a one form. So I can use gauge field. Right. So good. So hopefully the assumptions are explicit enough. And so let me just talk about some properties of the solution because it's very simple. So notice that the physics that we'll get depends on two parameters, naively. It depends on the temperature and the chemical potential, which are determined in the solution by these parameters M and Q. So M and Q appear explicitly here, and they're related by some functions with square roots to temperature and chemical potential. Because the thing is a CFT, only the ratio matters. Physics is only a function of the ratio.
Maybe you don't want to dwell on this thing, but just to make sure I understand. So yesterday I came back with the understanding that whether you have a black hole or whether it has Lipschitz corresponds to different ways in which you compactify this extra dimensions. So there's different ways.
Different ground states.
Technically, they will give you either F squared or the square root
of or something else.
Or something else, yeah.
And they'll also give you different values of lambda, and they'll give you different other fields in the dot dot dot, and different values of n, different values of the energy constant. Yeah. So yeah, that's where this landscape business comes in. Yes, sir.
R naught
is determined by it's where this function vanishes.
Okay, so it's something about Q and M.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. And okay, and so the limit that I'd like to talk about is the low temperature limit, where temperature is low compared to the chemical potential, since we're interested in some kind of cold matter. And in this limit, a funny thing happens. So if I told you what the temperature, I mean, you can figure out what the temperature was because I told you what, you know, the temperature is the coefficient of the linear zero here. And so you won't be too surprised if I tell you that taking low temperatures gives this function a second order zero, right? Meaning at low temperatures, the two roots of this function collide. And so that is, F becomes something like a constant times R minus R naught squared. And so in that limit, the metric, where did it go? It's here, approaches something like R naught squared times minus A R minus R naught squared T squared plus the R squared over A R minus R naught squared plus R naught squared T X squared, something like that. I think I got that right. And notice that this thing here, if I can, let's define sigma is, I don't know, R naught squared, R naught is R naught, is of the form sigma squared T squared plus D sigma squared over sigma squared, which is a number here, plus DX squared. I drop some factors. There's a number here, and there's numbers here. And this thing is ADS too. Okay, and so the geometry looks like this. So if I draw R increasing in this way, so that at this end, the geometry approaches ADS 4. This is the UV end of the geometry, where you forget about all this the fact that you turn on this chemical potential and the temperature. This thing is dual. The fact that this is ADS 4 is the same that we're studying a three-dimensional CFT. I didn't say 4. Did I say 4? Let's think about 4. So we're studying some, this thing is dual to some relativistic CFT in two plus one dimensions. And I picked 2 to pander to condensed matter physicists. And then at some point, there's a crossover scale, which is something like R over LADS is the order T over mu. And over here, near this horizon, so this is near R is the order R naught, the geometry, instead of ADS 4, is ADS 2 times R2. And this is this infrared end of the geometry. And by the general logic of ADS CFT, gravity in such a system should be dual to some sort of non-relativistic CFT, where this, notice in this ADS2, only the time direction is scaling with sigma. The space directions are just not participating in the scaling, and so this thing has some scaling variance where x goes to n. Let's say x goes to lambda to the 1 over z x, and t goes to so this is the equals infinity scale. Okay. And if we were at some small but non-zero temperature, the two zeros would be not on top of each other, it would be a black hole in ADS2 times R2. Okay. So that's the geometry. And now what are we going to do with it? Well, a very simple thing to do with it is the following. Let's suppose that amongst the dot here.
Quick question. Yeah, what does one know about the field theory corresponding to the simplest case? And what the field content is of the...
Well, okay. So, yeah, good. That's a tough question. So we'd need to find some... I mean, the way that I know how to answer that question would be to find a string vacuum which has an ADS4 ground state, ADS4 times something, where the action was of this form, right? Mm-hmm. And then ask, you know, what collection of D-brains produces that. People have worked on trying to find such a thing. And I'm not sure which one we should call the simplest. So the ones that people know how to study are some sort of gauge theory where the gauge group is a product of factors of UNs, and there's some matter in the bifundamental of pairs of factors, and it's supersymmetric. And I can probably elaborate some more. Maybe there's some double Trin-Simons terms. I don't know if anything useful is going to come out of continuing to.
Come on, identify the extent of degeneracy, and that's.
But in those cases, it's clear that the extent of degeneracy is just it's locally freedom that are carrying the energy.
In the field theory, they're not
something that's. Yeah. Yeah. It's in the infrastructure.
Wow.
You can just do D-ray counting the states of the intersection.
Okay. Sorry, there was another question.
I'm sorry, I keep going back to yesterday's talk. So there was a Lagrangian grid in the first slide, which had, you know, the UNC.
It was just three-dimensional UN gauge.
Yeah, exactly. And so the claim was that you start with that theory that has a known gravity dual.
That's right.
And then you turn on computer potential, we solve for the...
That's a theory that has a known gravity dual.
Right.
Yeah.
And you're saying there's another saddle point on the same theory.
It is, but it also is a saddle point of many other theories. And in other theories, it can be the dominant one.
I see. Okay. So for that particular theory, there's not the dominant one. So there may be some other theory called the
Yes, that's right.
But, and you don't have clarity on exactly what the other...
There was a Lagrangian written yesterday that also has this as the dominant saddle point at medium order margin. It was the second Lagrangian that was written, which was done very quickly.
This double Trin-Simons?
Exactly. That's what he was just saying.
Yeah. So it's some large engaged theory. Okay. If I don't make the next step, then it's much easier for me to answer your question. But then it's also not useful for me. Because I want to assume that amongst the dots here in the other fields that have small masses, and hence in the list of other operators in the CFT that have small dimensions, is some fermionic bulk field. Some fermionic bulk field, which is charged under this U1. And the reason I want to do that is because I want to have an operator in the field theory that I can think of as something that creates an electron. Now, I guess the word like there is kind of important. So this psi is dual to some fermionic operator in the CFT. Let's put a subscript E there so you think it's an electron. This is the opposite of what Steve did this morning. And let's assume that d mu there is in order to like some kind of covariant derivative and also some minimal coupling to this gauge field A. And with just this information, right, and there could be some self-interactions of this guy. And those aren't going to matter because I'm just going to compute two-point functions. And the dimension of this xi e is determined by this mass. There's a mass right over there. B over 2 plus or minus m l e s. And this charge that appears here is the charge of this operator. So now, I say that, you know, I want it to be like something that creates an electron, but of course it's not, because it's a scaling operator in a three-dimensional, in a relativistic CFT. So really it creates some pile of goo. Right? But at least it's a Gaussian variable level operator, which is charged, which is fermionic. Okay, so that's what it has going for it. And then it's easy using the correspondence to compute the retarded Green's function of this operator as a function of omega n k. Okay, I don't need to write the definition of the retarded Green's function by solving the Dirac equation. Solving the Dirac equation in this geometry.
Wait, you're at zero chemical potential or finite
chemical? Finite chemical potential.
So then what is the scaling dimension of the field theory operating mean in terms of
it's the UV dimension.
And then if I have a Fermi surface in two dimensions, what's the scaling dimension of the fermion?
Oh, that's a hard question.
Maybe that's what we're talking about. I mean,
this UV theory is a CFT.
Yeah, this the UV thing I have some control over. Right? It's some.
I thought the UV theory had a finite chemical potential.
Well, the chemical potential, you know, the chemical potential has dimensions of mass, right? Has dimensions of energy. So it's something which affects the theory, you know. It's like a relevant perturbation.
Oh, I see. Right.
Its effects go away.
Oh, I see. It's okay. So mentioned in the ultraviolet.
Right.
Yeah. How do you know that the IR is it is true?
From this, so this is this. Oh, there, okay. There's a piece of intuition that I didn't explain, which is that this radial coordinate plays the role of the RG scale. So the region of the geometry where it goes to infinity is associated with the ultraviolet. And so this analysis that we did where we looked at the geometry near the far infrared describes the infrared. And so it's because this thing is ADS2 that I'm saying that. Okay, and so this is easy to do numerically, and the answer we got for some example, so GR at some omega near zero and the function of k, there's some, you know, there's a big spike there. That's some k, which let's just call it kf. And there's a bunch of other stuff over here that I'm not going to talk about. And this was near zero frequency. Near by zero, I mean the chemical potential. Let's measure frequencies from the chemical potential. And this bump in the Green's function disperses with some dispersion relation, which is like omega goes like k, so that is k, you know, k minus this special value to some power. This amount of we call it v sub f. And that's a power that depends on the mass and charge in various ways. So this is the result of some numerical analysis. And then to understand the behavior near the Fermi surface, we can take advantage of the structure of this picture to help solve the Dirac equation in an expansion around zero frequency. And I guess I won't do this any justice, but the answer obtained by a matching procedure where we solve the equation in ADS2 exactly, this is something that's not so hard to do, and then use this as a boundary condition, solve the UV equation in an expansion about omega equals zero with the ADS2 solution as a boundary condition, matching somewhere around here, produces a Green's function that looks like this. So for omega near zero and arbitrary k, it looks like some coefficient, which I'll explain in a second, and the curly g over coefficient where, let me color code it. So it's which ultraviolet is this color, and infrared is this color, where this a plus or minus and b plus or minus are some UV data determined by the solution of the equation in this region. which we have to find numerically, but which is analytic in frequency. Something like this. Square. And so it's power series in frequency, and these coefficients are real. Whereas this infrared data.
They depend on K.
They depend on K, yeah. And this infrared data is this curly G, which I would like you to think of. It's of the following form. It's a function of K and some power of omega, where this omega depends on M and Q, and actually depends on KF. Well, okay, depends on M and Q. And I want you to think of this as the two-point function of some operator in the infrared series. Well, sorry, this isn't just my desire. It's this thing is the Green's function that you get if you thought of this thing as the whole world, if you just studied the Dirac equation in ADS2. And so by ADS2 CFT, this is the Green's function of some fermionic operator in that theory. And it takes this power law omega just because it's a scaling operator in a one-dimensional, a zero plus one-dimensional CFT.
I'm sorry, can I just ask a question? I mean, this is boring me for a long time. So in what sense is this the fermi surface of the system rather than you just taking some raw fermion, which is dual system, composite fermionic operator in the dual system?
Yeah, good. I didn't say the Fermi surface.
When you draw this picture on the left-hand side, I think.
Well, so, you mean, why do I call it KF?
Yeah.
Well, okay. It's the Fermi momentum associated with this operator.
Okay, so it's the Fermi momentum with this particular operator, but in your dual field theory, there could be some fundamental fermions which have a totally different
case. You mean which fermions which are not gauge invariant, which are tied into the gauge group. Indeed there could be, or maybe there could not be.
You just don't worry about those.
Well, I don't have access to those in this solution of the theory. The practical point of view is I'm calculating what I can calculate using the gravity solution.
There are other things that I read that are n squared degrees of freedom, which are invisible to you.
Yes, that's exactly true. The important point which is being made is that you can compute the density of this fermion. So psi e. What do I want to do? We can compute in position space x t equals 0, psi t x equals 0. And so this is something like the density of the charge density of this particular fermionic excitation. And indeed, this thing is order 1, which is order n. It comes in as a loop effect in the bulk. Whereas the total charge density, I guess I should have said this, you can compute from the solution. This is over n squared. Yeah, so this is a very important shortcut.
Here's a question I asked you before, but I would appreciate your insight again. in this form that the infrared Green's function of your emergent ADS2 is governing the fermion response for your probes.
Yeah.
It's a little confusing, this question was asked to me also, because the peak in that KF may actually be at scales comparable to mu, where it would not be
it is at scales comparable to mu.
Right, where it's not yet clear the ADS2 has emerged in the geometry.
That's totally correct.
So, can you get an intuition for why the infrared Green scale the Fermi source, even though KF could be way out of the...
Yeah, so let me first explain where KF appears, and then I'll try to answer this. So this is the form of the Green function for any K at small frequency. And so then you can ask, well, how do you ever get a Fermi? How do you get a picture? How does that happen? And you can see that from the structure I've told you here, that will happen when at a value of k where this coefficient a plus 0 has a 0. And that's something that's determined by solving the Dirac equation at zero frequency in this external region of the black hole, which you can write as a Schrodinger problem, And it's really it's just finding some bound state in this well. And the support of that wave function is definitely not localized in the ADS2 region. Rather, you know, this problem is something like, so here's the radial coordinate, here's the effective potential. It's, I'm not sure if I'm going to get this right. It can't go to infinity if it has a finite mass. And there's some big bump. I guess it's a zero frequency Schrodinger problem, so maybe something like this. There's some bump that keeps it from going into the ADS2. And so, you know, it's really some pretty boring thing where the wave function is going to be localized somewhere far away from the horizon. Okay, and so the form of the Green's function near that point, I'm going to answer the question in a second, is something like a constant over frequency, which comes from expanding this. So this, you know, this term is zero, that term is here, there's a vf, and then there's an other constant times this ADS2 Green's function. Okay, so the picture the important contribution to the Green's function clearly comes from, at zero frequency, comes from this excitation, right? Because, you know, it creates this pole in the Green's function. So we know other examples where some zero energy state is localized far from the infrared, you know, far from the infrared of the geometry. Let's see, what are the other examples? I mean, I guess Goldstone bosons are a really good example. Right, good. So there are some sort of exceptions to this rule that the radial position is the energy scale. But the way in which the ADS2 appears here is that if I turn on a finite frequency, so this is at omega equals zero, is the white curve. I probably am drawing this wrong. But it's something like that. If I draw it instead at some small non-zero frequency, this part is the same, but then there's this giant pit. And so this, whereby this state can tunnel into this ADS2 region. And so this thing is this rate for this state to tunnel into the ADS2 region, which, and I mean, that is certainly in the far infrared. Okay. And so notice, so this is the answer. And so notice the self-energy of this, so there's the Fermi surface, the self-energy of the quasi-particle, the would-be quasi-particle is determined by this infrared CFD Green's function. Something I didn't get to say was that the C here is complex, so the imaginary part of the self-energy comes purely from here, and so it's this exponent by which the thing disperses is completely determined by this nu, and whether or not this nu is bigger than or equal to half determines whether the thing is a Fermi liquid or not. I guess if it's bigger than a half, then there's a stable quasi-particle. But the imaginary part of the self-energy, the single particle lifetime, is this funny power.
Do you have Luddinger's volume satisfied? I mean, you calculate the density. Can you get the density precisely?
I don't know a good answer for that, actually. I don't know.
You don't know?
Yeah, because, so, there's a big little here. So this there's a there's a short distance singularity in this thing that I haven't overcome. I think...
But you could try harder. What would volume even be?
Well, there's...
Look, KF. The question is, does KF squared related to that density?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. He's not some Fermi operator which adds charge 1 under the global U1.
It's conceivable that it does.
You can compute the contribution actually perturbatively in the basically 1 over n. You can do 1 over n corrections and you can see that that does contribute what you'd expect. But it's sort of swamped by this large, you know.
But does the coefficient agree numerically with?
It's the volume of the Fermi surface. That's right. Yeah.
Oh, it does.
Yeah. So you can. I mean, basically, Suvir has basically done this, right? In this latest paper, where he doesn't. He doesn't treat the horizon curve.
Exactly.
So you can do it without that assumption.
It's only been done in the literature, from what I know, for cases where the charge is outside the horizon.
That's right. Yeah. So basically.
And so this that's not the case here.
Yeah, that's right.
You should write a paper about this.
Right. Yeah. Okay. We're working on it. Yeah. But the statement is that there's a you can compute the contribution of this operator to the total charge density.
So which operator do you mean?
This fermionic operator, the one who's
that one doesn't contribute to the charge density, which John calls the total charge density.
Well, it does.
It's just down by one over n squared.
Yeah, that's right.
So you can calculate that.
But the way in which you wrote it, in which you added it to the action, this psi, big psi, psi e, is just a probe, right? And all you're probing is the overlap with some other fermions, or maybe this particular fermion, which is in the background, which you call, which contributes to the total. So you're probing an overlap. This introduces no charge.
It introduces no charge classically, but the reason I say it's order n to the zero is because you can compute a diagram like this, which is the diagram that Nabil was talking about, mm-hmm. which it does contribute to the charge, but it contributes something negligible at large n.
Okay.
But does the operator capital Psi dagger add one charge to the?
Yes.
Globally, you want in the field theory.
Yes.
Okay.
So then one could have expected a little bit here where this object.
Yeah, no, I think so. Nabil is saying it's true.
Yeah, that's
true.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
All right, how many other such fermionic operators are there? I mean, was this, you chose this one because.
Well, so this is exactly this issue that. So.
Because the number of these isn't conserved, is it?
This yes it is. There's a conserved U1 under which this is charged.
It's just the total.
No, you're right. The number of these things themselves is not necessarily conserved.
So why should it sound
like? Yeah.
So should I say something that I think is related? So imagine you have many, many fermionic surfaces, right? Then you get one constraint saying the sum of all these fermionic surfaces is the total charge density.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you can establish a relation like that. However, in the holographic setup, you also need to take into account that there could be a large charge behind the horizon. So you should add that to this total thing. The charge behind the horizon is somewhat mysterious for reasons that John is talking about. But nonetheless, you can write a relation that involves both these states and the charge behind the horizon. And
the question is, if you added another fermionic operator,
yes.
If we give a second Fermi surface,
yes.
Would they each satisfy a separate Lagrange?
No, just the sum.
One total.
Just the sum. If it's the same U1, then it's just one constraint.
Okay, so let me make a comment about this other fermions. So earlier before I said anything about fermions of finite density, I made a big deal about the fact that these theories where there's just a few low-dimension operators at large n are weird because we don't have access to most of the, we can't use those operators to take one state to an arbitrary other state. Right? Most states are not connected by these operators. And so this is a very similar situation in that it could be that there's a theory where there is just one low-dimension operator of this form, but it's weird in that sense. And I guess more generally, you'd expect to have some sort of power of such operators.
But the scan dimensions that you're talking about, low and high, are in the ultraviolet. Is that?
That's right. I'm talking about their scaling with n and with other parameters.
In the ultraviolet. Yeah. But how do you know? Just because they have a large scan dimension in the ultraviolet, why are they in infrared? They can be important, but I don't admit. Theory can be structured.
No, there is a good reason, which is that their scaling dimension in the ultraviolet determines their mass. It determines the mass of the corresponding field in the bulk. And except in very exceptional circumstances, if I have a field whose mass is some enormous thing, then I could just forget about it. There are some exceptions that we know.
In the UV, just to be sure I understand, if you add some charge, it will affect the metric. Is it taken into account?
Ah, good. No, this is an excellent question. So the word people have been. Disparaging what I've been doing by using the word probe, and this is exactly why. This is a good reason. So I've been ignoring what Sean referred to the other day as the Landau damping, so the back reaction of this finite density fermions on the on the geometry. So I'm ignoring that.
Is it a good to I mean is it a good reason to do that?
For most questions, it is a good idea. There are. I will come in a moment to a question for which it's not a good idea. So for arbitrary little frequencies, it's not a good idea. Okay.
John?
Yeah.
Question, just sort of stepping back from all of this for a moment.
Yes.
Just trying to see if we have a sort of guiding principle, given what we're keeping our eyes on the prize, in terms of should we always, in retrospect, expect that we should have a flow from ADS4 to something that's non-relativistic?
Well, we turned out a chemical potential.
No, it can turn out that it becomes relevant again in the IR.
Yeah.
You can definitely get ADS fours coming out. In
right. So that was my question. I mean, is this just an accident or something? And what you're saying is no, that's not special. I could have.
Yeah, sometimes you get ADS.
So the lesson we take away is that there isn't really special anything special about it being non-relativistic in the infrared.
Relativistic is a closed condition, right? So in that sense, not being relativistic is, the sort of generic expectation.
Okay.
Yeah, but no, your point is taken. That certainly with other ingredients, other things that you can see. Right. So okay.
John, I have a second. Even in the horizon notional case, there is land out damp. I mean, the Z has changed, and so I mean the stuff behind the horizon has also land out damp. I mean, there's a density. I would say.
Absolutely, I agree. So right. But specifically, I didn't include the back reaction of these fermions. But yeah, that's a good point.
Sorry, just one more. I mean, I just want to make sure I understand. Do you know or not know that this capital Psi is conserved? I was just confused about that.
Okay.
Maybe.
The number of capital Psi's. It's conserved at leading order at large n, independently of anything else. At finite n, it can turn into something else. Yeah, so in the classical approximation, it is. Yeah. Okay, so I guess let me assume that you've all heard about the semi-holographic description of this, since, to save time. And let me make a brief comment about transport. This is so most of the things I'm going to say about this have already been said, but. So the conductivity by which. We can think about it as a function of frequency and temperature, by which I mean something like the imaginary part. I guess I don't need to take the imaginary part. Jx, jx at, say, exponential omega at k equals 0, where jx is this current. And I compute this by studying the fluctuations of this gauge field, has the following form. It has a classical contribution. Classical means it goes like n squared times a delta function at zero frequency, which you all know why it has to be there by now. And this piece here, so this is the classical contribution, and I can describe it by a Feynman diagram, where the external states, the asymptotic states, just labeled by the ends of the lines. Are the excitations inserted at the boundary of ADS. So this is, I guess this is something called a Witten diagram. This line is meant to indicate the boundary. This is the gauge field propagating through the bulk. This is what computes this. And this thing has the form that Sean described on Monday. And there's another contribution at order at one loop, which comes from a diagram like this, where this gauge field excites the bulk vacuum and creates a pair of these fermions. This is the psi field in the bulk, and then is absorbed, which part of which I will call the contribution from the Fermi surface. So this part is the contribution from the Fermi surface. There are other things of the same order. And we can isolate the contribution of the Fermi surface by its singular nature at low temperatures. So it gives a contribution which is non-analytic in T at T equals 0. Where the non-analyticity is related to this exponent mu. And so there's a long, horrible calculation associated with this, which in fact still has not appeared on the archive, but four or five authors of the paper are present in the city this week, and so maybe there's a chance that we can finish it. We're going to finish it. But the point of what I want, all of what I want to say is what I like about Z equals infinity is the following. It's that, so there's a single particle lifetime here, this thing I call tau, let me call it tau sp for single particle. The fact that the reason that the current can be dissipated in this problem is because the charge carriers can lose their momentum to this infrared CFT. And the degrees of freedom of the infrared CFT have a dispersion relation, which because of the fact that they have z equals infinity, goes like k to the 1 over z, which is a constant. So independent of k. And so that means that by scattering off of these effectively localized degrees of freedom, these interactions are very efficient at dissipating the current. And so because of that, the single particle lifetime determines the transport lifetime. Large angle scattering dominates. And I guess more, without appealing it to any Boltzmann equation intuition, vertex corrections are suppressed by further powers of n. And so this, this answer is just the answer, full stop, and the Fermi surface contribution to the connectivity goes like 2 to the minus 2 newton. So this exponent is the same as this exponent here.
Is there any intuition behind that that's quick? I know you're horrendous.
Why it's the same?
Why it's the same exponent?
Well, it's what I said. It's the large angle scattering dominant. So the way the
entire measure of these is coming from.
Well, the way the quasiparticles decay, the reason that there isn't a stable quasiparticle is because of this, because they're scattering off of these infrared CFT degrees of freedom. And that same process, whenever that happens, the momentum of the charge carriers is also dissipated.
So what are these local degrees of freedom?
This non-relativistic CFT dual to the ADS2. What are they? I don't know, they're made of the gauge theory. This is an output of the gravity dual.
So how do you think about it in terms of the gauge theory?
We think, the only reason I know that it's there is because of this gravity solution.
So you're taking some CFT and then you turn on faint potential, you're saying there's some degrees of freedom that just become local dissipative box.
Yep.
But that seems fine-tuned.
But is there any other example where that happens? Does it involve... But do you have an intuition why that happens? You take a CFT, you don't get faint potential, but you get localized dissipative degrees.
What are you looking for? You're looking for solution of
a strongly coupled
large angle problem?
Sure. Actually, that's the problem.
Well, I know, but understanding what fields are responsible, we have for a better picture than we do.
Yeah, I agree. All right, let me mumble some words. You want me to mumble some words, so I'm going
to... I want you to mumble some words. That's all I want.
So it's like what Shaman said earlier. The bath comes from the fact that there's n squared degrees of freedom per point in the field theory, right? These theories are weird, right? Each point is individually in the thermodynamic limit, right? And so sometimes they nevertheless manage to talk to each other, right? Like when we have a simple ADS5 solution where stuff can still propagate. But in this case, somehow turning on this finite chemical potential allows the individual points to forget about each other. And they can nevertheless each be a strongly coupled theory on their own because of the fact that there's n squared degrees of freedom there.
But it really happens with finite chemical potential.
Yeah, I don't have a good understanding of why finite chemical potential is enough to instigate that. But it certainly is what makes it possible.
No, you say ADS2 does not exist finite.
Yes, I do think that.
But if Joe has detected some symmetric ADS2s, is that possible? Is that too strong? I know that.
They don't have any of the usual instabilities. I'm not sure how they reflect on this problem, though.
with protected supersymmetric ADSTs. Say a little more about what they are.
They're mixed magnetic brain solutions of Doker and. So they don't have any. They seem to really be stable ADS2 solutions.
Are they theories of just ground states?
Well, that's the thing. They can't be because they have non-trivial dynamics.
Okay, but then.
But it's not clear what that non-ground state physics is, right?
Yeah.
It's ADS2 times a non-compact state.
Yeah, times a plane state or times a plane arrow.
And there's a magnetic field in the plane or something.
Yeah.
But these are classical solutions. I mean,
classical is and yeah.
But how do you know that that something bad doesn't happen to them at 9 a.m.?
We check. We say something bad. I mean, we know the spectrum becomes free at 5 a.m. But we don't know how. But in terms of, we check. Well, they're supersymmetric, so that pretty much protects you from and from mm-hmm. all the usual instabilities. And also, we've checked in the neighborhood of the supersymmetric point, and they remain stable. But it's sort of like maybe like the discreteness that John was talking about in the first lecture of just the discreteness of the eternal black hole. You don't see it in the geometry at all. You only see it when you.
But you would if you make a thing out of microstates.
Yeah, you see it in the microstates, but you don't see it in the geometry. It might be.
Okay. Well, the reason that I said that I didn't think it survives to finite end is because of everything about the information paradox.
Right. The spectrum doesn't remain discrete, but it might be.
Right. And I'm sure that this thing doesn't survive to finite end. These properties of the resonation black hole. Okay. So that's the whole point of what I wanted to say. So, but let me just beat this a little bit harder to say that we should contrast this with the case of a Fermi surface coupled to a critical boson. Where small angle scattering dominates, and this E goes like the answer that you would get based on the single particle lecton plus a little extra from the inefficiency of the scattering, from the fact that only a fraction of the scattering events dissipate in momentum. Both of these things are true. I should say, in this kind of approximation of where the bath, the stuff to which the scattering is happening, never returns the momentum. Right? So we're studying a system where translation variance overall is preserved, and there's a finite density. So if we wait long enough, the momentum will eventually be returned, and there should still be a delta function. So this is another opportunity to mention this. To connect with this information paradox, that I think that the time that it takes for that to happen is again this Poincaré recurrence time, and so this again is true on timescales shorter than this n squared. I've been dancing around this point the whole time, but let me just say it very explicitly. Okay, you need to hear me say this. This is not a stable t equals zero state of matter. It's not a stable phase. It's not even a critical point, because this thing has a zero temperature and area. The area of this thing is not zero, which is both extensive and proportional to n squared. So it goes to infinity in both thermodynamic limits, in the semi-classical approximation where we take n squared to infinity at the very beginning, it looks like there's an extensive ground state degeneracy, but of course at finite n, this degeneracy will be lifted, and a useful way to depict this is to draw a plot of temperature versus 1 over n, where so far we've been talking about this line here, where you could imagine, this axis is the same, sort of the same as this axis. So up here is some relativistic C of t. So here's, let's put mu here. So this is, this is some, ultraviolet dragons that we don't want to talk about. The physics, any physics that one might hope to get from the solution is somewhere in this regime. And so less, much less than mu, but still above this curve. which goes to 0 and goes to infinity, but which goes up like this, like e to the minus n squared. Below which, I don't know, we can call this t star or something, below which something else happens. If not, you know, if nothing else happens before that. And so let me say a few words about interventions. What interventions can occur to restore the good name of the third law of thermodynamics. So the first thing is at least quantum gravity effects will split these apparent degeneracy, exactly the same kind of other saddle point solutions which contribute at order e to the minus n squared can come in at order e and remove this.
What saddles do you have in mind?
I don't know. But we know that there's a lot of them.
You know what? Or you just mean the microstates?
Well,
what do you
I don't think I know another example that contributes here. But I mean, we talked about another example that contributes for the Schwarzschild black hole. But you know, we know that there can be other things, right? We know that this is an asymptotic expansion in 1 over n, and at this order, we don't know anything, right? There are ambiguities in our understanding of this order, at least from these things. So, you know, this is to say that, you know, once we start arguing about the effects of the small, we should really.
Just 1 over n squared.
1 over n squared. Good. No, I don't. I don't think that can dramatically change the geometry, though, right? Let's see. So, I mean, it's true that, I mean, we did talk about some 1 over n squared effects of, you know, which are only there at finite densities. So it's not just for normalization of the bulk couplings. So, I mean, you could imagine some. Well, okay, let me say the second example, which is kind of a 1 over n squared effect. But so this the second example is this 1 over n squared effect, this correction to the density, it looks like it's something that you can ignore compared to, you know, there's some stress tensor, which is order n squared, which, you know, to which this is subleading. But a point that was made in section 7.4 of the paper, some sections of which Eva talked about yesterday, is that in the far infrared region, as R goes to R naught, this back reaction of just this one fermion is not negligible. And in fact, its back reaction produces a Lifshitz geometry. Instead, replaces this ADS2, meaning z equals to infinity, with some Lifshitz geometry with z equals n squared. So, you know, n squared is nearly infinity in this region below this temperature. Okay. So that, I guess in some sense that's an n squared effect, that is a 1 over n squared effect, but it still only affects the geometry at temperatures below this exponentially small scale. Okay, and then finally there's a much more ordinary, okay, and I guess I should say the same kind of idea of taking into account the back reaction of the bulk fermions has been implemented in other examples where it's not such a small effect and leads to this thing called the electron star, which we should find some way for someone else to explain that. yeah, and then but finally the third kind of intervention is actually much simpler, which is that ordered phases can intervene, and this can happen at temperatures which are much more reasonable, and so, you know, to see this, suppose we redid this calculation here. Oh, it got erased. If we redid this calculation of scattering a charged something off of the black hole instead with a charged boson, you can take the retarded Green's function of a charged boson operator. And we would find a pole in the upper half plane representing some kind of instability of this charged boson, which tells us that it wants to condense with some TC, which is with some TC, which dimensionally is proportional to mu, and the coefficient is some number. And so that's some line here, which h bar is independent of n, which is I'm going to draw here. This is TC of some holographic superconductor, and now, so then I'd like to say that the physics that I've been belaboring for the last however long is valid, you know, below the chemical potential, but above where the superconducting phase intervenes, and its utility depends on having some hierarchy between these two scales, and you know, there's a numerical number appearing in this coefficient, which depends on the mass and charge of these bosons. So this is, I should emphasize, with charged bosons, charged bosonic operators, which and it varies. Now, I guess so. There's sort of two extreme alternatives. One is that there's always a charged boson which condenses at a temperature of order of the chemical potential. In which case, well, you know, maybe we should be excited about this because, you know, if we knew how to make a superconductor where the TC is of order of an electron volt, we'd be pretty excited, right? on the other hand, maybe it's smaller, which is, you know, closer to our experience, in which case there can be this regime where this ADS2 physics is relevant.
Sorry, question? Yeah. Another question, actually. So, am I correct in thinking that you don't really know the exact field theory on this set, but you know all exact correlation functions?
Yeah, that's right.
So is it possible to verify, let's say, some word identities or some?
Yeah, they're all satisfying.
Okay.
Yeah, we can talk about this later. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Is this condensation of the bosons happening in the flow limit? I mean, if you include the back reaction of the bosons, wouldn't you also get
it? It's still a continuous phase transition, right?
Yeah.
Where above the transition, it looks like Rajanarshan, and below it's some other geometry where there's a superconductor. Right?
Which removes the ADS2 signal.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just saying there's also superconductors which do have an ADS2.
Oh, I see. But this is a different question, yeah.
Okay, you just
right. So I don't want, maybe I'll downplay the fact that the superconductors that we can describe also have some critical degrees of freedom, which is, you know, maybe not the
most. Is there ADS2 in any of them?
I don't know.
Yeah,
there certainly are ADS4.
Well, with a charge condensate with still the ADS2?
Well, okay, I don't know what, but at least with the people
if the phone actually.
Okay, good. Charged, yeah.
I see. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm gonna wrap up. Thank heavens.
Two of us are wondering why, you know, should the theory tell you whether it condenses or not?
Who, the boson?
Yeah.
Well, whether there is a boson or not. You said we have charged bosons.
Right,
do you have them or don't you? Or could you choose to, or could you not to?
The apparent choice, the illusion of choice made by my words is coming from the string landscape. So there, you know, in a given string vacuum, there's a correct answer for whether or not there's a charged boson operator with small dimension, and I'm just, you know, scanning over the space of choices in
my description.
So whether or not it's there,
and you just can't compare energies because you don't know the action, you know, the center points.
No, you can. I mean,
you can.
Right. So you know, TC is over mu is a well-defined number, which and Sean studied and with Frederick Deneff some, you know, big list of examples. And found some, you know, some picture of where the TCs appeared, depending on which, you know, cone over some breeze corn. Does that answer your question?
So there are many theories and many TCs, I guess.
Those are possible with some of these compactifications, which is the
different
compactifications. Boundary theory is different theories.
Yes, that's right. So I'm limiting my remarks to cases where there's a classical gravity theory with large radius, and I think it would be very interesting if we could learn something from cases where that description breaks down.
No, there may well be theories.
Anything, and the physics might be very different.
Yeah.
that's a requirement.
Require, well, no, I think...
So you're just saying take one that we...
I don't know about stringy, but certainly all of the unphysicalness that has appeared on the blackboard is because of large n. And to do better, we have to study finite n. Right,
that's a decoupling.
Yeah.
Of course, these are complicated operators, so, I mean, that doesn't
count. Yeah, some finite, the finite coupling. Yeah.
Maybe the degrees are from the start of the energy.
Yeah.
And then we are talking about layers.
Yeah.
Is it possible that there are cases where I have control over radiant safety without running on tensor potential, I can calculate one over n directions? And then turn on tensor, does it make a, is this calculation for me?
No.
Sorry.
No, it doesn't. Mean.
So if I do it that way, suppose I first calculate one over where I know everything about where I probably better control because I do three and turn on camera dimension. Then I can control.
But what are you having in the safety?
I mean, it doesn't flow. Nothing happens. The data function is zero.
It would be very interesting if you could learn something by doing that. I don't know if you can. I'm very suspicious that you can. I think you can. Okay, I'm just going to make two concluding remarks. The first thing, or even one. The first one is we know many other examples of strange metals that have the same kind of structure. Other strange metals from Z equals infinity things, and the first one which we've already heard about is a Fermi service coupled to classical phonons, coupled to phonons above. T-phi. Mm-hmm. Exactly all of the same physics appears, in the sense that, you know, this T-phi is h-bar times, you know, it has an h-bar in it, times, you know, some normal frequencies of the lattice, and if we're at a temperature above this temperature, we can treat the phonons as classical, which just means that the individual atoms are, you know, on springs and are vibrating independently. And when the electrons scatter off of them, they efficiently dissipate their momentum, and exactly the same story obtains.
So it's because it's a lattice, and that's why it comes the different points in space decouple. A wave can be classical.
Well,
so it's not just classicality, but the fact that it's a lattice. Is that where the locality of space is coming from?
No, I think the same would be true if it were just a bunch of billiard balls.
But that's not C equals
This is a good question, actually.
Yeah, there's a mass momentum. Yes, it is. This is what I should say, high frequency that they don't talk to.
It matters that they're stuck. Yeah, that's right. It doesn't matter that it's lattice, though.
And they're separated.
Yeah, so I'm just saying if you had a bunch of random wells, right? It doesn't matter if it's pure God. But it does matter that there's some restoring force. Yeah, so that means they just can't escape from it. Yeah. Good. And so in the same way...
So that's not really emergent. I mean, they really put in that Z equals infinity is sort of microscopically there. Right?
It's just from the fact that it's a classical system.
It's like the other theory that's doing this, right?
Yeah, that's right. But so I want to emphasize that if in the same way you forgot about quantum mechanics, so that's, you know, set h-bar to zero, that's the analog of setting n to infinity, and imagine taking the zero temperature limit, you would think that this thing had an extensive ground state degeneracy, right? So in fact, in this case, Max reminded me that it's worse than the other case because the entropy goes like, you know, the number of atoms times the log of the temperature, right? So it even diverges in this case. So this is much less physical. So then there are some other examples that are worth mentioning. One of them is this spin incoherent Luttinger liquid, which is studied by Feet and Valence, which is an extreme example of spin charge separation in multiple one dimensions, where the energy associated with the spins, which is, you know, it's like the Debye temperature of the spins. So this is valid in a regime where we think about a temperature in between that energy and the energy associated with the charge. And so the charge degrees of freedom scatter off these classical spin degrees of freedom. And again, you get a very efficient anticipation of current. And again, and the correlation functions are long range in time, but short range in space in the same kind of way.
Where did the localization come from in that case?
So it's an output. It's
what happened?
The correlation functions are localized in space and long range.
Is that a picture? What are you?
No, spins are fluctuating wildly on the perpetual motion.
Right. So think about localized spins. The spins are classical. There's no coherent propagation of waves.
The spin is stronger than the passenger as a sign.
I kind of don't think it is actually. This is a good question, which I'd like to understand. So then the third example I want to mention is an example that Sabir has emphasized, which is the friendly service coupled to there's many adjectives that go here. Some random effectively d equals infinity spin system, which Sabir and Jimmy VA studied and effectively argued that it has the same physics as ADS2. As the least, as a zero plus one dimensional safety. Spin system.
What about a condo, a large condo lattice?
I think that is another good example.
But eventually, it's going to go from the quick
state. Yeah, but the couplings between the spins are generated somehow at higher order in 1/n.
But this quantization.
But in the regime where it's not
a two-channel or a 27-channel, no problem.
Yeah, I think that's another good example. So in each of these examples, the quasi particle, the would-be quasi particles at the Fermi surface are killed by some localized degrees of freedom, which would have a zero temperature entropy if you naively continued that description to zero temperature. The temperature at which that description breaks down has very various dependencies on the parameters in the problem. The fact that it's exponential in the small parameter here is because the rearrangements that are required to split this degeneracy involve n squared degrees of freedom. I mean, you have to talk to each of the matrix elements of the matrix to tell them to rearrange their state. Whereas in other cases, it's going to be parallel on the couplings.
Is there a 1/d expansion around the infinity there that shows any interesting properties, or
I don't know.
First, I think Subir's thing is an infinite range.
Okay.
But you could imagine some expansion in some in 1/r.
Everything is covered.
I hope to have convinced you that the apparent unphysicalness of many of these problems associated with the would-be ground state degeneracy is the same that's the same kind of error as thinking that the black hole eats information, right? It's because of this non-uniformity between these various thermodynamic limits and the t equals to zero limit. So that's. I'm going to stop.
So when do you start up tomorrow?
I'm sorry.